Welcome to The Better Picture, your call-in Red River Radio talk show on photography. Tonight, we welcome Michael Dinella to our show, and for the next hour, Michael will be here on air talking about the hows and whys of photography and ready to answer your questions on composition, exposure, distribution or sale, or anything else you may be wondering about in the wonderful world of current photography. If you have a question or comment, call in 800-552-8502. We have Red River Radio staff and volunteers waiting to direct your call. If you haven't seen Michael's work, you can go to thebetterpicture.org to see some of the photos that Michael has shared, or you can go to mdonellaphoto.com to see a more exhaustive sample of his work. If you're listening while driving, well, you're just going to have to wait for the descriptions to flow over you. We don't want you looking at that while you go. So let's get started. Welcome, Michael, to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
Well, we're glad to be here. Now, you've been shooting pictures for 50-plus years. Not telling your age, but for a while. How did you get started? You started young.
Yeah. Well, I am over 50, and I did start young. My mother had a Brownie bullet camera, which was kind of a, you know, obviously film, but a box-like thing, which I thought was an interesting device. But I think also looking at family albums, black and white pictures of family and other people of kind of a different era, got me interested in pictures and how I might enjoy taking some pictures myself. So my mother let me use the Brownie bullet camera. And back in those film days, and particularly back in the circumstances of my growing up on the south side of Chicago, a roll of film was a very big deal. So I, even as a 10 or 11-year-old, would plan for sometimes days what I was going to take a picture of. I would plan the subject, the location, framing, you know, what it was going to be. So I could use, I believe back in those days, there were even rolls of film with 8 frames. So I would plan how I was going to use all these 8 frames.
Well, that's different from today when you can go out and shoot 300 on a card and never have to change the card. What was your purpose of taking them? You did these plannings. I mean, what drew you to the subject matter that you chose?
Part of it was, like I said, looking at the family albums and kind of seeing people that I knew but at a different time, at an earlier time in their life, or seeing things, even things that were current at the time that I couldn't really see, or see places that I couldn't really see. And so I enjoyed looking at pictures for information or to kind of escape. But I also found myself looking at certain pictures for a while, just contemplating what's going on in that picture. I mean, like I said, I grew up in Chicago. And one of the things in a city like Chicago or any other city is that if you look at people, like, you know, we rode the bus to get around or the subway. If you just look at strangers, it won't take very long for you to get a remark, what the blank are you looking at? So you learned kind of early on that you really couldn't do that. So there's a little piece of it, of me, that says, well, with a camera, if I see something interesting and I can capture it in a camera, it's something I can study. That was a part of it. But I think that the chance to create something or to save a memory was what really got me started. I think what kind of kept me going was my mother worked at the Chicago Public Library, and therefore we had books around us all the time. We had library cards, and there was the traveling branch of the library. But one of the things I always picked up, in addition to other subjects that I had to pick up, were books about photography. So even, you know, at that age, I was fascinated reading about photographs, reading how they were made, what kind of equipment was made, and what I might do to make a picture like some of those that I would see in the photography books.
Well, and that's fascinating that at that particular very young age realize this is something I can carry forward.
Yes.
I can do. Yeah. Now, do your kids do that? Have you encouraged them? Or
Like perhaps some other photographers, it's kind of been a double-edged sword with my kids, because I've got four kids. They're young adults now, and I think that for the early part of their lives, they might not have recognized me without a camera. And certainly, we went through phases where they clearly were annoyed that I was taking pictures of everything. But it got to a point a few years ago, maybe more than a few years ago, that two things happened that signified a change. One of them was that they would decide that they wanted or needed pictures of certain events, certain times in their lives, either for school or for some social activity. And they would always turn to me and ask me, where are the pictures from this period of time, assuming that no matter what the event was, that there was a picture somewhere.
If Dad was there, we got it recorded.
Yeah. Yeah. And so most of the time there wasn't. But the second thing that reflected a change was that recently, not all the time, but they've actually asked me to take pictures of them or for them. And then when you asked about whether they're involved in photography, oddly enough, two of my kids, and I could perhaps say three, but so my youngest daughter ended up getting a job right out of college as a publicist for a photography and film studio outside of Philadelphia. And she tells me that even though she majored in something that didn't have anything directly to do with that, during her interview, she was asked how much she knows about photography, and she told, at least she told me, I don't know what she really told the interviewer, but she said, well, I know that, you know, you have to edit photos, and you might say, well, you know, this bottle is not appropriate, it's a distraction, or I need to get this side of the light. And she at least tried to convince me that's how she got the job.
Right.
I have...
She actually listened to you when you were growing up?
Yeah. Yeah. Two of my other children are involved in the media and the film industry, and one actually, I don't want to out her, but she works for NPR, and she writes and has used pictures that she has taken, as well as some that I've taken. So.
Have the children ever come to you and said, how do you do this? Have they sought instruction from you in photography?
Not really.
No.
Not really. I mean, they've seen me at times talk about what I was doing with editing, and I have some young nephews and nieces, and at holidays, at certain times, I remember one time in particular, I had taken some pictures and I put them on the computer, and one of my young nephews got very curious, so I explained to him what I was doing, and it kind of gathered a little crowd, but other than that, I don't think there was any real formal.
You know, in the shift to the digital, and like maybe thinking as you put it on the computer and people are seeing it, I mean, it's instant.
Right.
You can go. Do you miss the old days of having taken your 8 exposure roll and waiting 2 days and see what it is? Is it like Christmas coming open? I mean, has that been a change?
It has been a change, and you're right. It was like Christmas coming, but sometimes it was very frustrating because it wasn't always 2 days, and you know, sometimes I could walk to the drugstore, drop it off, and it might, you know, it might be a week, but and maybe we'll get this later on. The film processors, in general, were very, very good. I mean, in those days, the frustrating part of it, not only the delay, was the fact that you didn't know your mistakes until then.
Right.
So it could be a surprise. Everything turned out great. You know, you had the settings right, light right, composition, et cetera. Or it could be that you had something wrong and you repeated that wrong thing, you know, a wrong exposure, too much light, you know, dead flash, all that kind of stuff. And you wouldn't know it until you got the pictures back and you spent the money, which was a big deal
right
at that time.
Well, as most professional photographers will tell you, everybody's made every mistake at least once,
yes,
you know, showing
yes
up.
Yes.
For our listeners that don't understand, Michael's here talking about photography, but actually Michael is a practicing lawyer and has been his whole professional career, as well as a professional photographer, which is a little unusual to have matching professions. We've had other guests, my good friend, Chief Judge Carl Stewart, one of the top appellate judges in the country, Dr. Glenn Mills, great oncologists. Both of them are fabulous photographers, but they're not professional. And just to give a little plug to the station here, Michael's not only a great lawyer and photographer, he's a great citizen. He has brought some prints to help us with the fund drive next week. So June 7th, if you tune in while I'm on, we're going to be working to get rid of one of those. So that's a good thing. We have a call?
We do. And this is Ray from Fairfax, Virginia. Ray, go ahead.
Hello, Michael. This is Ray from Fairfax, Virginia. I've got two questions. One of them is technical. How do you deal with, I've looked at some of your stuff online, how do you deal with when you're shooting musical acts on stage, just the intense variations in bright spots and dark spots? And then my second question is, when people say a picture can tell a story, can you tell me what that means for you?
Okay. Thanks, Ray. First, on a stage with lights in it, that's something that happens a lot these days. I think it's one of the advantages of the digital technology, which has come a long way, but it's also something that could possibly be handled in the pre-digital film days, but it's a lot more of a challenge. So basically, there are a couple of ways that I approach this, and one of them is if you pay attention for some interval of time, there often is a pattern. It might be a random pattern, but there's a pattern of how the light comes and goes and what colors and all that. And if you pick a spot that you can focus on, meter on, you know, make your settings for, and work that same spot. And when I say work it, I mean you may have to take lots of pictures of that spot or that location. And you may have to adjust a little bit if you have the chance to look in the monitor. But if you focus on that spot, that's one way to deal with it. Another is if you want to focus on an individual, maybe a face or a guitar, or just focus on that, a meter on that. Spot metering can be extremely helpful in that situation. Even center weight metering can be extremely helpful in that situation. But stay with that, even as the lights are moving around. Stay with that, click, several times. Now, some of them are going to wash out, but I think I find that that's a pretty good strategy. And, of course, there are other ways that people deal with. And I'm assuming, you're not using your own flash, because that never happens in a live concert. The second thing was a picture. What was it? A picture tells a story?
Right.
Okay. What that means to me is that, you can be looking at pictures. You can be looking at any picture in a gallery or online, and all of a sudden there's one picture that makes you stop and look at it. And you don't necessarily recognize right away what it is that made you stop, but you look at it and you think about it, and it may come to you what made you stop and look at it and think about it, but it may not. It may not come until later, and you come back and look at it again. I mean, I have a couple of pictures I've taken. There's one, if my children will forgive me, I would have liked to have brought it here so you can see it, but it's in the category of a family picture. But essentially what it is one of my children, again, I don't want to out her by giving her a name, is leaning, and she's about 7 years old, but she's leaning at the edge of a sofa, leaning, kind of wistfully looking at her mother, who's sitting on the sofa on the opposite side, looking a little bit tired, and worn, but not badly so. They're not looking at each other. And, my kids have told me that's the best family picture in history. Good enough that we recently tried to replicate it, with the same people. And the replication is funny, but it's not the same.
Right.
But that's just one. So I don't know if that's specific enough, but something that makes you stop and think is what the story might not even be the actual story, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit, but if it creates a story in your mind, that's kind of what I think about.
you know, it's interesting. And Ray, thank you for those questions. Those are great. You talked about being able to see your mistakes immediately. Mm-hmm. With film, if you were washing out your performer's face every day, mm-hmm. I mean, every shot, you wouldn't know it.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
that really is. In the technology changes to digital, you brought in the white balance, you mm-hmm. bring in so many different things. How did you make the transition? I mean, you're over 50 by your own admission, but you know, you grew up with film when you had to use tungsten, or you had to use daylight, or you had to use fluorescent.
Yeah.
How did you make the transition over to digital? What dragged you to this side of the photography realm?
Well, I think the quality of the digital technology, and I didn't jump on the digital bandwagon right away. I mean, I was late, relatively late to the game, and part of the reason was that as digital photography came out and was talked about, and you know, it made photography accessible to a lot more people, which is a great thing. But I still read a lot, and I still do, about photography all the time. And one of the consistent themes in the early years of digital was that, it's remarkable, the improvements are dramatic versus 2 years ago or last year, but it's still not the same quality and capability as film. And I kind of was stuck on, if I'm trying to get the best quality possible, then I've got to use film. What happened for me was, this was, I'm going to say, about 2002, 2003, that earlier than that, maybe about 2000 or so. I happened to get a pocket camera, a small Samsung digital camera that I thought it would be convenient, because by that time I was using SLRs. You know, I'd gone through Kodak and Instamatic and all through that, but I was using manual SLR cameras, and they were big, relatively big. So I got this pocket camera thing. Oh, it would be convenient for just quick shots and instantaneous shots. And I used it a little bit, kind of walking around, because it was so easy to have in my pocket. And when I looked at it on the computer, I was astounded at the technical quality of the pictures. I did not expect them to be that sharp. I just didn't expect it to have the character that it did. And I still, you know, found film to be superior at that point, but I thought, well, this digital is not as bad as I thought it would be. So from there, I went and got my first digital SLR, which was a Nikon D70. So it was kind of their entry level at that time. DSLR, and I started using that alongside my film cameras. And by then, I was into the Nikon semi-automatic series. I was using a Nikon N90 and a Nikon F100.
Well, once you have the lenses,
yeah,
it's kind of like the razors.
Right.
We'll give you the razor. You have to buy the blade. You have the lenses. You can go.
Yeah. So what I would do was I would, particularly when I was traveling, I would take the Nikon kit, the Nikon SLR kit with me, and I would take the digital, the 70, and stuff that I really cared about, that I figured it had to be excellent, I would use the film cameras for. And, you know, I'd gotten familiar enough with those particular cameras that I was pretty good, even without the technology, at judging what I could do or what I couldn't do. And I would use the digital a little bit and was sort of impressed with it, to the point that I got the next level Nikon digital, the D200. And when I go on long trips and I was worried about losing equipment or getting equipment damage, I would then take my Nikon N90, which was, by that time, was my second camera, along with the D200. And I remember there was one trip, remember it specifically, in fact, that one of the prints I left off here was taken with that D200 in Italy.
You were bringing the digital as a backup, just in case.
Yeah, Yeah, as a backup, or if I just wanted something quick. The long and short of it is that I never took the digital. I never took the film out of the box, out of the suitcase. I was shooting with the digital just because it was convenient.
Well, that is great. Our guest tonight, if you tuned in late, is Michael Danella. He is a compliance officer at Murphy Oil in El Dorado, Arkansas. Welcome our El Dorado group. If you have a question, we're at 800-552-8502. Now is the point, Michael, that we generally stop and have a quick smartphone tip, because some of our listeners don't have the choice between the DSLR and the digital and the film. And the tip tonight is dealing with zooming on a smartphone. You all know you can kind of spread your fingers and zoom into it. But understand that that is not an optical zoom. You're not really like putting on a telephoto lens on one of your big cameras or my big cameras. What you're doing is you're just telling the camera, use just a little part of the sensor. So the resolution goes down. It's not as sharp. I don't recommend it. Take the picture and crop it later on the computer, because it's the same information that's hitting it. Unless you don't like to fool with stuff afterwards, it's a quick snapshot and you want to cut a cousin out of the picture and send it to social media, then you could zoom in to do that or walk closer. I find it's easier to step forward and get closer. You know, the motto of the show is get close, stay focused, and keep shooting. The only other time you would zoom on a smartphone is if what you're taking really want in the picture is either much brighter or much darker than the rest of the picture. If you zoom into just that, the newer phones will readjust and average just what you're looking at instead of the rest, so you get a little bit better exposure. But basically, you don't want to zoom it all the way in, because it's going to degrade as far as a serious photograph goes. And smartphones now can take some real serious. Got another call?
We do. Let's welcome Carl from Shreveport. Carl, go ahead with your question or comment.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. And, Michael, it's nice to hear just kind of a conversation on radio for a change. I think you're kind of going in the direction that I was going to, that I was thinking about anyway. When smartphones and cell phone technology began to get good, and the phones and the cameras actually began to take good pictures, I used to take pictures because of the limitations that they had at the time. I could get very interesting shots out of cell phone pics, and I wonder if you've ever done that. You know, in the way that an old brownie would take a certain type of photo, cell phones, particularly in the early days, had some fisheye lens effect and other things, you know, that just I could stage a picture that way.
Well, Carl, I may have an old Apple One that I can find for you if you're interested. And that is a problem. They've gotten them so good that you are losing some of that particular. Let me ask you, Michael, do you use your cell phone taking pictures?
I don't use it very often to take pictures, and it probably out of laziness is what it comes down to. I mean, I've learned these cameras like my hands. And don't get me wrong, I do use them, and I really respect the quality. But I just, every time I take a picture, all I can think about is my Nikon in my hand.
Right, and there is some familiarity. And, Carl, that may have been part of the problem is you were familiar with the old way and what it did, and they upgraded. They put better tires on your car, and it doesn't slide around the corner. So that's great. Appreciate the call. I think we have another call coming in.
Yes, we do, and we've got, this should be Joyanne from Shreveport. Joyanne, go ahead.
Hey, I had a question about your film processing. Is that something that you send off, or do you do your own film processing?
I actually have not used film in several years, but when I did, I sent it off. And one of the things I was getting to when we were talking about the transition from digital to film is these days, there are far fewer film processors than there were 10 or 15 years ago, and I hate to sound this way, but I think there are fewer film processors that are really good and really care about doing it. So I send film away. I have a couple of places that I use because they know me. And that's the main reason. And it's, you know, it's maybe a little bit more expensive, not a lot more expensive than some other places, but in the long run, it's less expensive because they know me, they know my file system, and they will get it right.
Very, very few of us have ever done color because it's so temperature critical. Mm-hmm. And you're right, we have lost some of that. The black and white, you can still get the chemicals, and you can do that if you want to do the effects and go back and do it like Carl, and you can treat them a lot differently. But I think that is a problem. And I appreciate Joy, and that's a good question. I know most of the Walgreens and other places do it. So appreciate the question in. It's going to be harder and harder to talk about film as we go forward because not many are using it. Appreciate the call. We got another call coming in right behind it.
We do. This one from Washington, D.C. This is George. George, go ahead.
Hello, Michael. Thank you very much. This is interesting, and I've really enjoyed looking at your pictures on Ross's website. You were talking a moment ago about the film and adjustments and making the pictures, and my question goes to the process of making a picture. We all look through the viewfinder, we compose the picture, and we take it and we make the adjustments, and then you get to the computer and you've got a whole array of tools to adjust lighting, mood, cropping, and so forth. Talk about how you make these pictures, please, and how much of your process is in processing as opposed to standing in front of that charging horse with your camera.
Yeah. Thanks, George. My process, and you know, it's not necessarily standard, is if I'm taking there are basically two kinds of ways I approach, you know, taking the picture. One is if I'm on an assignment where I've got to get something, whether it's a band or a particular scene or whatever it is the assignment is, I make sure I get the shot, you know, and the shot may not be the best of the shots that I see, but if that's what I'm supposed to get, I make sure I get it. If I'm out, you know, just trying to be creative, to test things, to see what I'm interested in, then I might experiment some more. And that experimentation might be less dramatic than it sounds because it might be shooting something I've shot dozens of times before, but I just see it in a different light, et cetera. So from that point, then I go back and look at the pictures. For example, the South Arkansas Symphony played on last Saturday at our Symphony on the Square. And so I was covering that, but really for my own fun. And I go back and look at the pictures. I'm picking pictures. So I go through and I look at all of them, and there are a lot of them. But I'm choosing pictures that I think reflect both the mood of the audience and the overall atmosphere. So I'll have pictures of some of the crowd, some of the people that are standing by, some of the musicians when they're kind of at rest, but also pictures of the performance, you know, both the stage as a whole, but individual musicians. So I go through, I pick those out. Then from among those, I try to make it like a manageable number at first, 12 to 15, but it usually ends up being like 25 or 30. And I rank them by hand, you know, 1 star, 2 stars, 3 stars. So I pick the best ones, whatever caused me to give it 3 stars, pull it and look at it. And what I'm thinking about is, you know, what is this picture about? What's the technical quality? Is the lighting right? Or if it's not right, is it interesting? Should I adjust the light? Does it need sharpening one place or another? I almost always crop them. And the cropping is based on, what is this picture about? You know, is this a picture of our conductor at work? If so, then maybe the crop will be Kermit, but at work, the faces of the violin players beneath him. Is the picture a picture of a singer? Then maybe it's just a headshot, or maybe it's a full body shot. But basically, that's what I'm doing. I'm thinking, you know, what is this about? And oftentimes, you know, I kind of once you have all that there, there can be things that you didn't think about. And most of the time I'm doing this alone, but occasionally I have some portrait clients that will sit with me, you know, kind of quickly saying, you know, which ones they like, which ones they don't. And, you know, I go through that, and I try to go through it quickly because I'll see something that I think, well, that's good, but you can't tell yet because the light hasn't been adjusted or it hasn't been cropped so that you see that if you, you know, crop this stuff out, as Ross said, you take the cousin out, then it's a completely different picture. And that can take that can take some time. I mean, you know, I never worked in a dark room, but I have many friends who did, and it seems to me I spend as much time in the digital dark room as they did in the actual physical dark room. But I almost never will send a picture out that I haven't edited.
George, that's a great question. On everybody has a style as to what makes that speak to you. Just a little background, because we jumped right in and the call started coming. Michael is a practicing lawyer. You did not set out to be a professional photographer. I mean, you don't have an accidental lawyer. You know, you have to go to law school. You have to study the rules of procedure. That doesn't teach you how to plead a case, but you have to get the technical side that's down. Whereas with the photography, you can say, hey, I'm a photographer. You'll buy the pictures.
Yeah.
How did you move? I mean, you started with your mother's bullet camera, but how did you move into a professional aspect from the legal profession?
Yeah, well, that basically started, I'm going to say, around 1992 or so. And the way it happened was, it was really, actually, I'm getting my years mixed up. It was earlier than that. I'm trying to think of when I first started consistently traveling internationally as a lawyer, and that was probably, I want to say 1990 or so, maybe a little bit before that. But anyhow, I would always try to remember to take a camera with me then, and I started showing people in my office some of the pictures just because I thought they were funny or interesting or whatever. And so some of my colleagues asked me to take pictures for them, for their family events or certain other events and occasions. And I would do it because I enjoyed doing it. I was flattered that someone would want me to do it. And it's kind of at some point around that time or shortly thereafter, someone offered to pay me to do that. And again, it was a personal friend, and I was flattered by that. And I got encouraged, particularly, I would say, by the person I consider my teacher, Bill Burkhart of Wesleyan University, that, and you know, it's a whole nother story, but we went through kind of a long sort of personal teaching, him teaching me, but he said to me that, you know, you should be displaying these pictures, you know, should be showing them, not just taking them and giving them to somebody. And so I was very flattered by that because he's a great photographer and great teacher.
So once people start saying, I appreciate your vision and I like that, and I have an idea that we have a lot of listeners out here that really have some good prints in their closet, mm-hmm. same way that you do. But mm-hmm. but when you people say, oh, can I buy that? Mm-hmm. That's different mm-hmm. from a commercial enterprise that says, I'm going to go shoot a band or a yeah. album cover. I guess it'd be a CD cover now, yeah. album. We are dating. Of course, we're both over 50, so mm-hmm. that's okay. We can talk about albums.
I'm well over 50.
Yeah. So transition for me, if you will, because you're still a lawyer.
Right.
I mean, you know, what's the skill set? Do you see any overlapping as you moved into the practice of photography while still practicing lawyer? Is it release or is it relief or is it
I mean,
how do they play off each other?
It's some of it's a release, some of it's just using a different part of the brain for both of those functions, And I would say, I told the story before about another one of my influences, and again, I'm not trying to place myself in the same category as him, but those familiar with photography will know the name Philip Traeger. He's known as the dance photographer. He has magnificent dance photos, and he has, you know, many other extremely wonderful photographs. But it turns out that we went to the same college. He's actually more over 50 than I am. But I was serving on the board during a time that he was being recognized with a gallery presentation at the school and an honorary degree in addition to his own. I had not previously known that he was a lawyer, a full-time lawyer at a big New York law firm, of which I know some of his law partners. And, you know, they're all serious, hardworking lawyers. One of the things he said, I mean, he had a couple of events that I was able to participate in. One was a sort of what I would call a workshop presentation that he gave. And one of the things he said is that for a large part of his career, and even during a part when he was taking magnificent dance photos, I mean, you can look him up and you'll see he is virtually considered the master dance photographer. During that time, he was a lawyer, and he said that he would never tell his law clients that he was a photographer, and he would never tell his photography clients that he was a lawyer, because in his mind, it would cause them to diminish their view of his commitment to either one. So in other words, he didn't want his law clients or colleagues to think he wasn't committed to being a lawyer, nor did he want his photography clients to think he wasn't committed to serious photography. And he said at one point he decided that was not right, and he should tell everybody both of those things about him, because they were the essence of who he was. And for me, hearing him say that, because I have to admit, I was like that for a while. I mean, there were law colleagues of mine that knew that I took pictures, but for a long time they didn't know just how serious I was about that. And there were photography clients of mine, you know, mainly musicians. I mean, a few of them knew that I was a lawyer, but a lot of them didn't know, and I really didn't tell them. But like Philip Traeger, I mean, I felt it freed up a lot of things. So that's a long winded way of saying there was a release part of it. But there are also things about how one approaches the practice of law that can inform how one approaches photography and vice versa. And I find it more often the other way around, that I'm learning things about approaching photography that I can use in some way or another in practicing law.
Well, in the analysis of going back to George's question and Ray's, I mean, how do you form a picture? What tells a story? Do you see that as a skill set that subconsciously or not? I mean, because of course, it's radio. You can't see his hands. When he talks about a camera, you can see him adjusting the f-stops and all that stuff here in the studio. It's second nature. But it still has got to be a developed skill set.
Yes.
Is the approach to the problem of getting the picture helpful in the approach to writing the brief or identifying the issue in law?
I think it is. There's a saying. I mean, one of the things that I have to do more of now at this stage of my law career than I did earlier is training sessions, particularly training on compliance and ethics. And you know, my law practice deals with compliance and ethics. So a lot of times situations arise in which a decision has to be made, a legal decision, an ethics decision has to be made. And there are times when people want to make a quick decision. They want to make a fast decision because these are problems, and people want these problems to go away. But in law, except for, you know, those, as you know, Ross, there's kind of that one quadrant of things where it's absolutely clear what's right and what's wrong, and another, or what's right, and then the other quadrant is absolutely clear what's wrong, and then everything else is kind of, it could be, depends on how do you develop these facts, how do you develop this texture, you know, how's the law changing, how's culture changing. So in law, you don't necessarily want to encourage quick decisions unless they truly are clearly right or wrong. You know, all the other stuff, I feel you want to resist the notion to just trust your gut, because just trusting your gut often leads to very bad legal decisions. You know, decisions based on bias, based on just improper reasoning. So you want to articulate why a certain decision is appropriate. But that can all change with preparation. With photography, you know, probably it's closer to correct to say you are rewarded for quick decisions, you know, being able to be there, you know, get the picture, get the right picture. You know, we talk about the golden hour, you know, those 5 or 10 minutes when the sun rises and between when the sun rises and it's fully in the sky. But so being quick in photography is, you know, just one thing where you can be rewarded for being quick. But as in law, you can only be quick if you're prepared. So having some preparation and some thought about at least generally what you're going to do and what tools you're going to use and how you're going to do it puts you in a position to be quick. At like in law, if you've studied the issue enough, studied the law, studied the nuance, studied the culture enough, what may appear to be a quick decision is really
culmination of a
culmination.
Yeah,
that's one. But there are all kinds of ways.
From the sounds of it, I mean, in your descriptions, clearly you work with words as well as you work with images. This is for those that are on the fence of do I go out and do this or not. This could enhance just about any profession.
Yes,
with that skill set of preparation, deliberative. Mm-hmm. Vision. I mean, you have to know what you're shooting at.
Yeah.
I mean, like I think George referenced the horse charging at you. It's one of the first pictures we have.
Yeah.
You know that horse is going to jump right there, but you still have to have all the technical stuff set up to that. So that is interesting.
Yeah, I gotta just say one more thing about that. And again, this is something I use both in law and in photography, and it is, you know, again with my ethics lectures. I say that when, you know, particularly in business settings, I'm trying to remind people there are all kinds of tools available, all kinds of technical infrastructure tools that help people, guide people, provide resources on making the difficult decisions, you know, either in law or in ethics. But you can't get so bogged down in the technical infrastructure that you don't pay attention to culture. And culture is like taking a look at the big picture, being able to step back and say, okay, what's really going on here? What's really affecting why things are the way they are? Similarly with photography, knowing how to work a camera is obviously important. Learning whatever you can about it, finding ways to improve. If you're worried about focus, how can you improve your focusing skills? If you're worried about light, how can you improve your use of light, etc.? But you also have to get to a point where you're not so bogged down with the technical that you forget, you know, what is this picture about? You know, so talking about composition, mood, the person, you know, with this portraiture, which is something I've, you know, grown to love and hate and struggle with. It's, you know, that observer phenomenon where once you are present in the thing that you're trying to photograph, you can change it, particularly with a portrait. I mean, you're standing there with a camera, even in street photography. We talked about that. You're standing there with a long lens and a big camera. You change the way people behave. Similarly with law. I mean, just for a lot of situations, the presence of a lawyer in the room changes the way people behave. So one of the tricks is, how do you either create something that is genuine despite the fact that you're in there versus can you find an approach where you can capture what's there without being in it? I mean, the concert hall is kind of the easy example. I can be in the middle of the concert hall and none of the performers will be aware that I'm in the room unless they're really trying hard to be aware of it. Or with law, I mean, you can influence players around the edges, but that's...
Well, it sounds like you have managed to distill a basic philosophy of life into the camera and into the court or into the law practice. And I think that goes back to before you can take the subject, you have to know yourself.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me as if what's a very solid philosophy of life is something that you have turned into, I can refine and nuance with that.
Yeah.
Now, you've got a commercial client that calls and says, I want this to happen, that grates against every nerve that you have.
Right.
How do you handle that where you obviously come to this with an almost romantic appeal to, I can capture something here, but you're on the their dime. What do you do? Have you had situations where they just are, you think, wrong with the client?
Yes. And what you do, and this is what I hear most photographers do, is try to make sure that you understand what the client wants. Because it's not always clear. A lot of times it's not clear.
You could substitute lawyer for client on that one.
Photographer. Just as in law, you're going to make sure you understand what your client wants. And to the extent that you understand that, you got to get that. You know, if they want a picture of this bottle surrounded by things that are going to complement one's enjoyment of drinking this bottle of water, I mean, you got to create that and give it to them if that's what they want. If they just want the bottle on a white page, clearly so you can see it, you got to give them that. So whatever it is they want, you got to give them that. But you can also use the opportunity to say, well, I have another idea about what might make this interesting that they might be interested in. You can try that out, just like in law, when people tell you they want this, and you think about it and say, well, yeah, but how about...
What are we trying to accomplish that, instead of what you want to do?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, that is good. And so when you have these competing demands on that, do you find that that has taken out some of the joy of taking photography?
Well, it can, and...
I mean, it's a job at that point, isn't it?
Right. It can, because, like I said, you got to give them what they want, and that means you got to get the shot. No excuses, no nothing. If it's a band, you got to get a frame with everybody on stage. You got to get close-ups of individuals. You got to get pairs. If they have a signature move, you got to get that. And, okay, so you can get that. So I got it. But then is it flat? I mean, is there anything?
Is a personality behind it instead of just the image?
Yeah.
Well, that's a band, and you can learn that, and you can watch them. And I think, as you told Ray, there are certain lighting patterns you can get ready to anticipate.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the portraiture, because then it's you one-on-one with somebody.
Yeah.
As you have so adequately said, beautifully said, the mere presence of the camera changes the conversation.
Right.
How do you get past that? How do you drop them? I mean, Catherine Gagne, one of our former guests, she just pulls images out of people that go, yeah, well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Well, give us a practical tip on
I'll give you
getting the good portrait.
There's some masters at this, of which I don't consider myself one. But one of the things that one of the masters, and I have to give credit to Joe McNally, is at this stuff, that you can create, instead of trying to draw out that person, because it might be someone that you really don't know that well, but creating a distraction that causes a reaction and being ready to fire away when that reaction is going to convey some genuine emotion. But you know, having some, and, you know, like I say, McNally's a master, but there are others. I mean, one of the best portrait photographers in history.
For the radio audience, Michael's now holding up a picture for you to see.
this is a photo of Winston Churchill from 1941, taken by Yusuf Karsh. Yusuf Karsh was known as one of the best portrait photographers in the world, and this is the iconic photo of Winston Churchill. You know,
the Harump photo.
The Harump photo. You know, people have seen it. It's probably the most reproduced photo in history. But you look at that, and you know, you can Google it, and you can see it. He's holding a chair. He's got his hand on his hip, and he is frowning. The way that picture came about was Winston Churchill was in Canada, speaking to Parliament. They had made arrangements for Mr. Karsh to photograph him. He had exactly 2 minutes. Mr. Churchill did not want to be photographed. He came in the room, proceeded to smoke a cigar. Karsh asked him, "Sir, kindly, would you mind putting down the cigar?" Winston Churchill wouldn't have any of it. You know, Karsh put an ashtray in front of him to please, sir, put out the cigar, and he wouldn't have any of it. He's got the cigar in his mouth. So Karsh grabs the cigar out of Winston Churchill's mouth, and at that instant, clicked the camera. And that was the spontaneous reaction that he got in this iconic photo.
I think it was described as one of the few defeats he suffered.
Yes.
You know, but absolutely. That is one of the, well, and that's, you know, that art of distraction, of course, was shot in black and white. And to me, the black and white portrait photographer is one of the highest art forms going.
Yeah.
Do you shoot black and white and color? You have a preference?
My default is color. I've shot black and white. I have black and white. I have, you know, photos that have been used locally that have been converted to black and white, and I think to great effect. I would say that my default is color. I'll convert it to black and white, which is not, as you know, Ross, not just a matter of pressing a button. There is texture to black and white photography.
But do you see images and go, God, that would be a great black and white picture, or does that come to you later?
And that comes later, and probably it depends. I mean, I can think of one. We probably don't have much time, but I'll just tell you, there's one that comes to mind that I took, and it should be in black and white. And the situation was, the boxer Joe Frazier was a celebrity host towards the end of his life in Philadelphia, and I was able to photograph him. Very, very nice man, by the way. I'm a big Muhammad Ali fan, but Joe Frazier's a very, very nice man. But seeing him kind of in this state of illness and weakness in his life, and he left this event walking down the street in Philadelphia on a cane by himself to his car, and I caught that image of him. Formerly a big, powerful man, he looks smaller than me, and I'm no giant. That's a black and white picture.
Yeah, that. And just as a practical tip, I won't ask you to say on air whether you have ever done this or not, but I have found that sometimes when there's a really dramatic picture and everything looks good, but it's a little out of focus, and you're afraid to send it on, you can convert it to black and white and turn the grain up and make it look like an old pushed Tri-X, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's an art picture. I will look at some. You don't have to fess up if you've ever used black and white to hide focus, but for those of you out there looking for tips, and if you turned in, it's not a bad thing to try. And just Michael alluded to, changing a color image to a black and white image is not just a push of a button. You can do that. You can drop out all the saturation. But if you have a picture that's really worth working with, go to one of the programs. Nick has some. There's some other ones that keep that richness of the tones that are in there. And by throwing grain up, take a small part of the picture that you really like and blow it up large. And sure, it gets pixelated and it gets fuzzy and grainy, but if you go back to the 30s and 40s and look at some of those pictures, some of the most dramatic ones have that that's going on with that. So that's that's just a cheating tip that I'll throw out there that you can go and try. It's better to keep it in focus, but while you're out there. Well, do you have any professional gigs that you just don't do anymore?
Weddings.
That's kind of like the divorce. That's the first thing. If you're not a wedding photographer, then stay away.
Yeah,
I've told the story, I think, on air that I went back to law school because of weddings in 75. Federal judges and mothers of brides are no real competition as to who you don't want to come up against as you do that. In 60 seconds, what advice would you give to the person that's got a decent camera, maybe all auto, maybe not, but wants to move from snapshot to photograph, photograph to art?
Yeah, I would say pick a couple of technical aspects, you know, whether it's light, whether it's focus, whether it's exposure, but pick one of those things that you think you can get better at technically and work on that one thing at a time. But at the same time, look at composition. And by that, I mean, look at what other photographers have done. You know, I want to say go to the library. You know, my mother was a librarian, but now I'd say, you know, go to the internet, look at that, and see pictures that make you stop and think. And then ask yourself, why am I stopping and thinking about this? And what is it color? Is it composition? Is it emotion? Because that's the other thing. We talked about distractions. Some people have a real skill at, you know, either creating the opportunity for emotion or of getting their subject to relax.
Well, that's great. If you were paying attention, you would have heard another tip that Michael threw out earlier. He almost always crops. Shoot a little wider, and that gives you some leeway. You can't add stuff to a picture afterwards, but you can take some away, and the cameras now have gotten that good. Well, this hour has flown by. We are running out of time. I would be remiss not to thank Michael for making the trip down here, for contributing artwork for our fun drive. Thanks to Kermit and all the volunteers. Thanks to Red River Radio. And especially thanks to all of you, our listeners, and people that have called in. Our next guest will be the local artist, Twin Blends, the Mangum Brothers, who are going to talk about combining old and new pictures and give you a little history aspect to it. But so, most of all, thanks to all of you. Michael, appreciate you being here. We could do this for hours. Remember, get close, stay focused, and keep shooting.